Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking into a really foundational document, something that lays out, well, the almost impossible job of local democracy, the South African Handbook for Municipal Councillors.
Yeah, and look, this isn't just about, you know, some dusty legal manual. We're using this 2006 handbook, published by Salche, with support from GTZ, ISA, and others, as a kind of detailed case study, really. It shows you what democracy actually demands from its local leaders. Anywhere, really.
Absolutely. And it came out right after the 2006 local elections, specifically to bring this new cadre of councillors up to speed. The mission, it was huge. Yeah. Equip them to, well, speed up service delivery, get the public involved, and basically be the political guardians of good governance.
To counteract poverty and create jobs.
Exactly. So it set this incredibly high bar right from the start.
And that's the core tension we're unpacking, isn't it? You've got councillors elected on political promises, fix this, build that, you know, end poverty. But then this handbook lands and says, right, now you need to be a top-level technician, a manager, an accountant.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
What is the core mandate, like the absolute foundation that guides every single thing they do?
Well, the handbook lays out three non-negotiable pillars. The first one is political. Mm-hmm. They have to act as representatives of the community.
Okay.
And that means really getting to grips with everyone, the demographics, different interests, the key issues facing all residents, not just the ones who voted for them. And then, crucially, providing constant regular report back.
Right, letting people know what's happening. So that's pillar one. What's the second?
The second shifts them, like you said, from just politician to more of an organizational leader, providing leadership roles in the council. So this is about setting the big picture strategy, passing the local laws, the bylaws, and giving that high level policy direction.
Policy direction. But there's a catch, isn't there?
A major one. The handbook is very clear. Councillors must avoid interference in the day-to-day running of things. That's the job of the municipal manager and the administration.
So you set the what, but not the how. Like, you decide we need a park, but you don't tell them which vendor supplies the benches.
Precisely. That non-interference principle is vital for keeping the administration professional and impartial. Micromanaging from councillors is a huge no-no.
Okay, but hang on. What about the third pillar? You said they're the custodian or guardian of public finances. How do they guard the money without, you know, looking under the hood? If they suspect waste or corruption in how those benches are bought, how do they act without interfering?
Ah, yeah, that's the tightrope, isn't it? Their job is to ensure integrity, professionalism, honesty. They do that by asking the right tough questions in council meetings, by demanding clear reports, ensuring strong oversight systems are actually working like internal audit committees.
So oversight, not orders.
Exactly. They absolutely cannot give operational instructions to a municipal staff member. The moment they cross that line, the whole administrative structure gets undermined. And frankly, it opens the door wide for political meddling and corruption.
Okay, so representation, leadership without interference, and financial guardianship.
Got it. Now, you mentioned something running underneath all this. Developmental local government, DLG.
Yes. DLG. It comes from the 1998 white paper on local government. And it's, well, it's the whole philosophy underpinning this approach.
And practically speaking, what does DLG mean for Councillor X on a Tuesday morning?
It's a fundamental shift, really, from government just doing things to or for people to governance, which means the municipality has to work with citizens, finding sustainable ways together to meet social, economic, material needs.
So less top down.
Much less. It means prioritizing basic needs first, sure, but also actively driving development with the community. Success isn't just about delivering a service, it's about how well you engaged people in finding the solution in the first place.
Right, which loops back to needing real expertise. This isn't just glad-handing and cutting ribbons. You need to know the system.
Definitely. The community expectations are sky high, resources are limited. You need to understand the laws, the finance, the planning processes inside out. Okay, let's talk about that legal structure then. Where does the handbook start?
It kicks off with the big one, the 1996 Constitution. That's what establishes local government as its own sphere, distinct but crucially interdependent with national and provincial government.
Not totally separate islands.
No, definitely not. But the real complexity comes from the stack of laws built on that foundation to make DLG actually work.
Like which ones?
Well, you've got the Municipal Structures Act, the Demarcation Act that draws the boundaries, and the Systems Act, which sets out how municipalities should operate. But the absolute key one, especially for that custodian of finance role, is the Municipal Finance Management Act, the MFMA from 2003.
Ah, the MFMA. That one comes up a lot.
It's the rule book for every single rand and cent. It dictates financial management, budgeting, reporting, auditing, everything. Mastering the MFMA is non-negotiable if you want financial integrity.
Okay, so there are laws, but the structures themselves vary too, right? Mm-hmm. The handbook mentions different categories of municipalities.
It does. And where you are matters. There are three main types. Category A, those are the big metros. Think Johannesburg, Cape Town, Ethekwini. They have all the municipal powers within their boundaries.
Self-contained, basically.
Right. Then you have Category C, the district municipalities. These cover wider areas, often more rural. And they oversee the Category B municipalities, the local municipalities, which sit within the district.
And B and C share responsibilities.
They do, yeah. Services like water or electricity might be handled differently depending on whether you're in a B or C area. And importantly, if you're a councillor in a Category B municipality with more than 7 councillors, your municipality is divided into specific geographic wards.
Got it. Wards. And the leadership structure within those councils can differ too. The handbook mentions different executive systems.
Yes, the Municipal Structures Act allows for 3 main ways power can be organized at the top. Knowing which one applies to your council is pretty fundamental to understanding your own influence.
Okay, what are they?
First is the plenary executive system, usually in smaller councils. Basically, the whole council collectively holds and exercises executive power. All councillors are directly involved in executive decisions.
More democratic, maybe.
Potentially, or potentially slower. Then there's the collective executive system. Here, executive power is delegated to an executive committee, which is usually made up proportionally based on party representation in the council.
So power is concentrated in a smaller group.
Correct. And the third system is the mayoral executive system. In this one, executive authority is vested in an individual executive mayor who then appoints their own mayoral committee, often from their own party.
So power is highly concentrated there.
Very much so. If you're a regular councillor in a mayoral system, your direct policy influence might be less than in a plenary system unless you're on that mayoral committee. Your role might be more focused on oversight and ward representation.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, if we connect this to the bigger picture,
mm-hmm.
you mentioned interdependence between the spheres of government. Chapter 2 really pushes this idea of cooperative governance. Why is that so vital?
Because the huge challenges, poverty, unemployment, boosting the economy, they just can't be solved by one municipality acting alone. It's impossible.
Needs teamwork.
Exactly. The local plan, the IDP we'll talk about, it can't just be some local wish list. It has to align with the bigger national strategies, things like the central government's program of action or the national spatial development perspective. That's about where growth should happen nationally.
And provincial plans, too.
Yes, the provincial growth and development strategies, the PGDSs. Alignment means everyone's pulling in the same direction. And crucially, it helps ensure that national grants and resources are used effectively, not wasted on contradictory projects.
Okay, so you need the legal framework, the right structure, and cooperation. Here's where it gets really interesting. Chapter 4. This is about the day-to-day, the core processes that actually govern what councillors do.
Right, the engine room. The handbook highlights 4 key processes. First, and maybe most important, is integrated development planning. The IDP.
The master plan.
Essentially, yes. It's the municipality's main strategic plan for its 5-year term of office. It's legally required, and it's meant to guide absolutely everything else. All the planning, all the budgeting, management decisions, everything flows from the IDP. It's the municipality's core promise to its community.
And it's not static, right? It needs public input.
Hugely important. Community participation is built into the IDP process, often through ward committees. And it's not a write it and forget it document. It must be reviewed every single year to make sure it's still relevant, still aligned with resources and community needs.
Okay, so the IDP sets the direction. What's next?
Well, the IDP naturally feeds straight into process number 2, municipal budgeting and financial management. You plan it in the IDP, you budget for it here.
Makes sense.
The handbook breaks down the 2 main types of budgets. You've got the operating budget that covers the day-to-day running costs, you know, salaries, electricity for municipal buildings, fixing potholes, that sort of thing.
Keeping the lights on.
Pretty much. And then you have the capital budget. This is for the big stuff, building new infrastructure, like clinics, roads, reservoirs, buying major assets. This is often funded through loans or, importantly, through grants like the Municipal Infrastructure Grant, the MIG, from national government.
And who signs off on these budgets? This must be a key power.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
The full council, all the councillors must approve the budget. The handbook stresses this is a non-delegable function. The executive can't just approve it themselves.
So councillors have real teeth here.
They do. And remember, the MFMA, it forces them to think long-term by requiring multi-year budgeting, usually looking ahead 3 years. So you can't just budget for the next election. You have to plan sustainably.
Okay. IDP plan, budget funds it. What's process three?
Performance management, or PMS. This is about checking if the plan and the budget are actually delivering results effectively and efficiently.
Tracking progress.
Exactly. It requires setting clear, key performance indicators, KPIs, and targets for services. You can't just claim you improved water access. You need metrics. How many more households? By when?
And these KPIs need to be solid.
They have to be measurable, realistic, achievable, and this is key, directly linked back to the goals in the IDP and the money allocated in the budget. You measure what you planned and funded.
And who checks this?
There are internal audit processes, but the big external check is the annual audit by the Auditor General's office. Their report says whether the municipality achieved its targets and managed its finances properly.
Okay, plan, budget, measure. What's the fourth core process?
The fourth loops right back to the community. Public participation and citizen involvement. This isn't just a nice to have. The handbook emphasizes it's a constitutional requirement.
DLG in action again.
Precisely. It reinforces that the community must be consulted, involved. The main formal channel mentioned is the ward committee system, designed to give communities advisory input, make development more democratic, and treat citizens not just as voters, but as active participants, consumers of services, and even partners in getting things done.
Wow, that's a lot. IDP, MFMA, multi-year budgets, KPIs, PMS, ward committees. I mean, how does a brand new councillor, maybe straight from running a small business or being a community activist, possibly master all this complex stuff, especially under intense political pressure?
It's a massive learning curve, no doubt. The system is demanding. And that's why the handbook stresses that it's not just about technical skill, it's about character. Chapter 5 really dives into the ethics and leadership qualities required.
Because without integrity,
the whole fragile structure collapses. Councillors are bound by a very strict code of conduct, which is actually part of the law Schedule 5 of the Structures Act.
What does the code demand?
Things like full declaration of all financial interests, assets, business involvements to prevent conflicts of interest. It explicitly pushes them to fight corruption, especially around municipal tenders and hiring.
Any specific red lines?
Oh, yes. A very clear one. A councillor is not allowed to be a member of a municipal bid committee or any committee evaluating tenders or appointing staff below the municipal manager level. Full stop.
Keeping politicians out of procurement decisions.
It's an absolute firewall designed to separate the political oversight role from the administrative implementation and spending.
That's a critical distinction. So there's the legal code. What else guides their conduct?
The handbook brings in the Batho-Pele principles. It means people first in Sesotho.
Ah, I've heard of those.
Yeah. They're the 8 core values meant to guide all public service in South Africa. Councillors are expected to constantly measure their own performance and the municipalities against these principles.
Can you list them quickly?
Sure. It's consultation, setting service standards, ensuring access, treating people with courtesy, providing information, operating with openness and transparency, offering redress when things go wrong, and delivering value for money.
So it's a moral and service compass.
Exactly. How well are we actually putting people first?
Now, you put politicians, administrators, and communities together with scarce resources. Conflict seems inevitable. Does the handbook address that?
It does. It acknowledges that conflict will happen. Common examples are tensions between, say, a ward councillor focused on their specific area's needs and a PR councillor looking at the party's broader agenda.
Or the classic councillor versus manager clash.
Absolutely. Especially around that tricky line of administrative interference we talked about. A councillor pushing too hard, a manager pushing back.
How should they handle it?
The handbook mentions the standard tools. Negotiation first, then maybe mediation, possibly even arbitration for some disputes. But the core message is, conflict is normal, but it can't be allowed to paralyze service delivery, or worse, compromise financial rules or ethics. It needs constructive resolution. So look, if we synthesize this whole deep dive, This 2006 handbook wasn't just theory. It was aiming to be a really practical, detailed roadmap, trying to take political promises and embed them in workable systems of accountability, transparency, and effective delivery, all within this very complex legal and cooperative framework.
It really demanded that the politician become a competent manager and guardian, too.
That's the heart of it.
So what does this all mean for you listening? I think the sheer depth of what's required here, mastering finance laws like the MFMA, driving the IDP process, tracking performance metrics, adhering to Beth Opele, navigating cooperative governance, it shows that being an effective local counselor isn't just about politics. It demands really sophisticated skills.
Skills in financial management, strategic planning, performance analysis, community engagement. It's a massive job description.
Right. And the handbook says the ultimate success of that big plan, the IDP, is judged by whether it actually promotes democratic, participatory, and accountable government.
Which leads us to a final thought. Remember that firewall between counselors and administration, especially around money. The MFMA makes it a serious offense, potentially jail time, for a counselor to interfere in financial reporting or management. Section 173.
Okay.
So consider this. If a counselor is found guilty of that kind of interference, crossing that line, what does that specific act do to the community's trust? Not just in that counselor, but in the whole idea of their local democracy. That failure of custodianship isn't just breaking a rule. It potentially poisons the well of legitimacy for the entire local system, doesn't it?